air just moments away from the WHFR Journal. Stick with us. This is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists. The WHFR Journal is next.
Welcome to WHFR Radio and the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw with you. We are officially celebrating the month of April, the month of spring, the month of renewal, new beginnings, and all those wonderful things that this season sort of allows us to focus on. So we are celebrating throughout the season opportunities to connect with our wonderful counseling department here at Henry Ford College. And this interview will showcase that very topic as we continue a series called the Counselor Connection Series. Joined in studio at this time with dear friend and licensed professional counselor Gwendolyn Pringle, who has been with HFC for many, many years. And Gwen, I suppose the first thing I'll say is happy Counseling Awareness Month here in the month of April. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to say that same sentiment to you and the college students, as well as the college community. April is Counseling Awareness Month. And as a matter of fact, I had the opportunity to attend the National Counseling Association Conference in Orlando, Florida. Mm. That was really a great experience for me. There were a lot of different workshops and a lot of training in terms of working with students and working in terms of peer development and different issues in terms of what people experience and want to work with the counselor in regards to working out some things in a person's life.
And I'm so pleased to hear that that sort of retraining continues to go on and awareness, because I would say it's probably safe to say that issues that we're dealing with right now for students, you know, are probably not the same. They don't look the same as they did maybe years ago, or frankly, even, you know, not all that long ago, because it's not always the same things, not always the same issues going on with our student population, is it?
Well, that's an excellent identification, because the world has changed so much. And so it has interacted with the people that we're working with. You know, I just really think about technology. And when I first came into the field, there were no computers on the desk. And now you can't operate without a computer. And, you know, as a result of the pandemic, we even got more into computers and online. And a lot of therapists now are actually doing their therapy via the computer. And as a matter of fact, when we had that pandemic, I was like, what's going to happen now? Counseling, what am I going to continue to work? But it was just wonderful how we transitioned. I got a call and said, well, do you want to work online? I said, of course. What does that mean? And then we were set up and we started calling students and were able to work with them online. So it yes, counseling has changed.
Yeah, and most appropriately, that was a time when counseling was certainly very much needed.
Exactly.
With that lockdown situation. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're in 2025 now. Things have ebbed and flowed since then, as we know, and probably drastically changed the mindset of you know, the world, probably forever. Mm-hmm. But what are some of the things that we're sort of dealing with today that you learned from your seminar, mm-hmm. that you can take into your work time here at Henry Ford with our students and our not just our students, but our campus community?
Uh-huh. Well, one of the sessions that I really attended was actually they've even written a book on positive self-care. And I think when you mentioned that the world has changed, people have changed, I think they embrace the concept of counseling and mental health and wellness. We in counseling like to focus more on wellness, making sure you stay well. And that's why I kind of like to focus on positive self-care, because it is so important that you take care of yourself. And even me as a counselor, I have to make sure that I do certain things to care for myself. Because even, you know, on the airplane, what do they tell you? Put on your oxygen mask first so that you can help other people. So I think that's a real big issue in terms of people really starting to take care of themselves and look at their whole wellness picture. And there's a lot of things that go with wellness, like the exercise and talk therapy really helps. One of the things that we try to do with students is we have, in counseling, we have like workshops. Now, one newer workshop that I put on, it was called You Matter. And basically, it was a program out of Princeton University, and they kind of put it on the internet, and you had different areas of wellness, and the students answered questions, and they looked at their results, and if there was an area that was kind of low, that might be an area that you needed to work on. I know very early in my career, I taught like for 30 years, a session called, well, it was a seminar called Human Potential Seminar. And it was based on the assumption that something is right with you, you know, rather than beating up yourself, but think positive and think that you have things going for you. One of the things they emphasize is self-affirming, self-determining, and being self-motivating. And the self-affirming, that is, you affirm yourself. You say good things about yourself. Self-determining is you are in charge of your life and you determine the direction of your life. You don't want to just sit around and wait on other people to tell you what to do. You have to develop your own goals. And self-motivating is pretty much the same thing, is that you motivate yourself by the values and the goals that you have. So those were some of the things that were in the seminar, and those are some things that I still use when I talk with individual students.
Okay, so we have to talk ourselves into feeling that we're valued. We then have to figure out our own decisions on what it is that's best for us, and then we actually have to implement it.
Exactly. Now, where the counselor comes in, counselors can be a sounding board to help you and guide you, but the final decision, you know, lies with the individual person. We're just there to kind of like direct traffic and, you know, be there and be supportive. I think one of the things is that when you feel more positive about yourself, they had another area where they talked about positive regard for other people. I think once you feel good about yourself, then you can be more positive to the greater community. And that's what I've found in terms of counseling. It's like the more I'm supportive, the more support that I get. There was a book many years ago that I read. It was called The Secret. And I was like, what is this book? And so I read it. And what it talked about, the laws of attraction. What you think about, that's what you bring into your world. Mm. And that's the new concept. It's kind of like, you know, the students use a vision board and kind of take pictures of what they want and what they want to be attracted to them.
Mm-hmm. So, just a modern interpretation
of
that. Yeah,
the modern interpretation of that, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Well, Gwendolyn, when we talk about ways to impact our students and empower them, really, I think I've heard you say the word realistic a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people's mindset is, you know, reach for the stars and, and you can be anything and dream big. And, and while I love all of that, and it's motivating, certainly, how important is it to create that sort of realistic roadmap for next steps so you can actually sort of measure achievement and success?
That's excellent. One of the things, when you start to set goals, now, there, even in the Human Potential Seminar, they had goal-setting criteria. First of all, when you set a goal, it needs to be achievable. You know, you have to say to yourself, is this achievable? The next thing is, you have to believe in that goal, because it has to get into your system. You have to believe it. Now, you also talked about specific and measurable. You know how we'll say, well, we want to reach for the sky, but, I mean, can you measure that? Okay, so I think it's important if you look at exercise, say, well, I want to just improve my exercise. That's not measurable. But if you say, I'm going to exercise for 30 minutes three times a week, that's more measurable, okay? And then that way you can go and see how you're doing with that goal, okay? I think one of the other things is you've got to want to do it. You know, a lot of times we're verbalized because we see other people do it. Oh, well, I want to do that. I'm going to be this. But you have to really want it. It has to be within your system. And another thing about when you set goals, you want it to be non-injurious to other people. Okay, so that's a theme that has to be in there. And you have to be motivated. That motivation comes through every time. You have to get personally motivated, okay? And, you know, as we think about it, we can think of other little things that, you know, kind of help you to get that goal.
And it sounds like the things that you're referring to involve a lot of sort of responsibility on the part of the person that is creating the goals, setting the goals, implementing the goals. But what if there's that mindset, but I'm not motivated, but I don't really want to do this. I know it's good for me, but I just can't, I can't nudge myself forward enough. I suppose that's where counseling comes in.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I wonder, some of the things that I would do is maybe have the person say, you want to do that goal, what's blocking you? What are the barriers? What's holding you back? Is it you? Is it other people? Do you need to change your environment? Oh, is it, are people telling you you won't be successful in that? You know, how much of the external control are you listening to? Because a lot of times when you, what's important is when you set a goal, you have to be careful. Not only do you have to believe in it, but the people that you tell the goal, they have to be supportive of you, because many people will say, oh, you'll never do that. And that kills the spirit. So it's important to make sure that if you're talking to somebody, they're going to be supportive of your goal. Because if you're going to tell somebody that's going to say, well, you're not going to be successful, you might just want to keep your goal to yourself at that point. Mm. Okay, but in terms of counseling, what I say is that I don't kill people's dreams, okay? Let's talk about the dream and let's set a plan and a roadmap. And this especially comes relevant in like career planning, because I teach a class in life work planning, and at this juncture, we're doing what we call informational interviews, and that's where the students have to go out and interview two people in careers that they're interested in. Okay, now, some of the students will go and interview, and they'll say, oh, I don't like, no, at the end, I don't like that career. But I say, that's wonderful. That's the best interview you could do, because now you know what you do not want, and now you can start to focus on some of the careers that you do like. So it's not a lost cause, even if you interview a person and you say, and that's why you interview, because you want to get that information, because, you know, you hear about a career, it looks glamorous, and that's why I like for the students to go directly to the source, because every career, there are some upsides and there are some downsides, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's what I say in terms of that issue.
And that makes sense. And it really goes back to if someone's actually talking to a potential employer, you know, learning about a job, and then that student says to themselves, I just don't think this is going to bring me fulfillment and joy. Mm-hmm. Might bring me some money, but mm-hmm. it's not going to do what I want it to do. To me, that's very self-affirming. That mm-hmm. means that you care enough about yourself to want to listen to that voice that's saying, this just isn't right for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's excellent, because even though you may be offered a job, and I've heard people get job offers and they say, well, I looked around the whole situation, the company, but I didn't think I would be happy there. And that's what's important, is that you feel good about the position that you're in, because you don't want to go to work every day sad and not fulfilled. And that's where I feel so lucky, was that I was able to find a career that I really like. And that's why I like to really work hard with the students that I see, so that we can try on some careers and see if you like it, because the key is passion. You have to have passion for what you're doing. And now, of course, I know that when you're trying to get to the career, you may have to take some jobs that help you in terms of, you know, money and things that you need. But many times, you know, you have that long-term goal focused there, and you do these little short-term goals to get you to your long-term goal. Mm-hmm. And that's another bit of information at the Human Potential Seminar. What we would do is each week we would set a short-term goal that would lead toward the longer-term goal that we had set. And, you know, I think it's important to set goals because I think that is a way I've gotten through education to my job, is to be able to set goals. What I do is, before actually the phone was out, I used to write my goals down for the week, but now I actually put it in the phone. So I've advanced with technology.
Well, we suppose we have to, don't we? Yeah. And you know what's interesting, Gwen, is you mentioned the vision board and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing more and more students go back to sort of the basics of clipping things out of magazines and posting them, and journaling, physically writing into a book, you know, and so on. I love that, of course, because it's kind of old school, right?
Right. Me? Oh.
Tangible, touchy-feely. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. I love books. I love reading magazines. And that, I think that is a key. It really helps you, because there's so many different subjects. You can go and read a book. They have so many help books now, too. So when you have an issue, you can't get right to the counselor, you can go to a help book and kind of read on it. So then you can start to work on how you want to proceed toward that particular problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, books are as they say, reading is fundamental.
Absolutely. Yeah. We are celebrating Counseling Awareness Month here in the month of April as we've kicked off this this new month here. Mm-hmm. And at WHFR Radio, we're so excited to be able to showcase our counselors in this Counselor Connection series. Gwendolyn Pringle is joining us, and Gwen mentioned the word passion. I can't think of a more passionate group on our campus than our counselors, I'll tell you. Very, very fortunate to have you. And learn things from, for example, the Human Potential Seminar that you're bringing back, you know, to us, and some of your favorite reads and so on. When we get into sort of moving forward with the concept of self-affirmation and so on, for students that feel potentially like, well, I don't know that I need to go see a counselor just yet, but I'm just feeling a little bit off, or I don't feel as motivated as I'd like to. Mm-hmm. Can you give us like a first step, like some guidance to just kind of try to get into the mindset of being able to comfortably put ourselves first and sort of self-affirm that we have value and deserve good things that hopefully, you know, because of that mindset will come to us.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that I wanted to talk a little bit about, one of the English teachers, she told her students, say, think about a problem you have. And I want you to go and discuss this problem with a counselor. And then you're going to write up the results. And it was really interesting. I really enjoyed the students because they came with some very interesting, you know, kind of concepts like stress management, test anxiety, self-doubt, procrastination. And those are some of the things that we encounter every day. And I don't know, now I think people are more embracing counselors because the students will come in because it's more about wellness. And just having somebody to talk to that's going to affirm you and reaffirm you and have a conversation about the issues that you're having. And the other thing is the goal plate of counseling is that what we talk about is confidential. So that I think that will motivate people to come in. But basically, on the college campus, there was a lot of talk about academics. How do I, you know, be successful in this class? You know, we can talk about relationships. There's a lot of different things that we can talk about. Now, what I find, I have a lot of students that come in and talk about career counseling. And so we have different focus, too. It's through technology, but it gives the student an idea of different careers to go into.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And these are things that we may have no idea that they exist until we reach out.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, and focus, too, it's a wonderful tool, and I use it with all the students, because the students just can go in, use the technology, answer the questions, and then they get a career portfolio. And they can use that. We can discuss that. And then there's another technology. It's called the Occupational Outlook Handbook. It'll talk about the nature of the occupation. It'll talk about earnings. It'll talk about advancement. And these are some of the things that students need to know. As a matter of fact, you know, we have the early college, and we have a lot of high school students that come in. And I think they benefit a lot from the Focus 2 and the Occupational Outlook, because what they're doing, they're sorting and they're trying to find what their direction is. And those are the tools that help to propel them to look at different careers. It's not that we're saying you have to make a decision right now for the high school students, but we want you to start thinking about what career it is that you want to work with. Because now our main focus in counseling is career development and personal counseling. We used to do, you know, a lot of the academic advisor. We still, you know the information because we have to keep up with the catalog. But the major focus is on the wellness with personal counseling and the career counseling.
We're so glad that you're here on our HFC campus to support and assist our students and our campus community at large. As we celebrate Counseling Awareness Month, Gwen, anything that you'd like to share that we have not yet dived into? And I know we've covered some things in our previous editions of the Counselor Connection series, which has been, I think, very enlightening. But so glad that, again, you are here for our students. And it's so nice to be able to shine the light on your area and all the important things that you're doing. So what else?
Well, one other thing that I'd like to talk about is values. And one of the exercises we used to do is that you need to identify what your top five values are. And guess what? They do change as you grow and develop. I remember when I was a lot younger, my number one value was financial security, okay? But as I've matured, my number one value now is health. So when I look at my values now, it's like health, family, education, wealth, and happiness. So I think that's something that people need to start thinking about is what do you value? What's important to you? Because I think your values will motivate you towards your goals. And once you get that clarity on what you value, then you can set some goals in relationship to that value. That's what we used to do in the Human Potential Seminar. You had to come up with your top five values, and then you had to set a weekly goal for that value. And then that way you know you're acting upon your values.
So, might be an interesting way to consider reprioritizing values that maybe aren't so good for you. Like if you're so concerned about how people perceive you or something like that as a value, maybe that's a little self-sabotage. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. Well, because, I mean, you think about a lot of people, you have a lot of self-doubt and they worry about what people say about them. I mean, me as a counselor, I'm concerned about that. But the key is you have to be happy within yourself. And I know it's easy to say, it's harder to do, but that's why you work with that self-affirmation. Yeah. Like, I am who I am, and I can do what I can do. And you have to be positive about yourself. Because self-doubt, you have to reassure yourself. Because it keeps creeping in. That's why I talk about positive self-care. Because if I don't, then it'll go toward negative. So that's why I keep reminding myself. Some people say, well, you got rose-colored glasses on. But I'd rather think positive because that makes me feel better.
And would you say it is sort of like a muscle memory thing? Like if you are having a challenge or a crisis, if you practice positive talk versus just going into the negative spiral, that's maybe more likely to kick in when you need it most? Yep. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. I can relate when I had a health challenge. The doctor said, oh, don't stir egg, don't move. And I said to myself, I'm going back to work. I'm going to beat this. And I think that's what you have to do is if you feel like you want to do something, you've got to put that positive muscle, like you said. And the more you practice and use that muscle, the firmer it becomes. And you reach your goal.
Yeah. Boy, when you break it all down, it sounds so easy, but we know it's not, right? Or everybody would be all happy all the time. But these are such important steps, such important things to consider. For example, sort of putting down the values. Maybe we have people that don't even think about what they value, and
right.
by sort of identifying it and then saying, yeah, maybe I shouldn't be valuing that as much, and I'm going to put health higher, or I'm going to put family or friendships and so on. It's a starting point, right? Starting point to kind of say, this is what I want to focus on with the time I have in my life, and then make it better if it's not where it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's most important to you? And like you said, it changes over time, okay? So you have to check in with yourself and see, do I still value that? Because sometimes it will change. Like when I was younger, I liked to party a lot. You know what? I was a young college student, you know, enjoying myself. But now I'm, you know, more serious. Yes, I used to.
Hey, we need photos. No, I'm kidding. I see that about you. You got that something going. That's very funny. But it's true. It really is. It's true. We and it's probably healthy, right? To as we reassess at any point in our lives, to then kind of consider shifting things as it makes more sense to you.
And then life will shift you too. Mm. Because things change. Now, that's one of the books that I use in my life work planning class. It's called Who Moved My Cheese? And my daughter says, why are you using that book? I said, but that book is so valuable because you know what it talks about is what is your motivation toward change? What happens when change happens to you? Because change happens to us all, and you have to be able to deal with that change, because if you're just kind of sitting around saying, I don't want it to change, you're going to be left behind. I think about me and computers. I'm like, what am I going to do with this? But guess what I did? I got on there, I changed, and it wasn't so bad at all. It kept me moving in my occupation and my career, because if I hadn't accepted the technology, then what would have happened? I would have been left behind. And now you have AI, and there's a lot.
And that's a whole nother conversation.
We won't even go there.
Well, Gwen, it's just fascinating. And I thank you for the willingness to keep up and change and adapt and grow, because then, and this kind of circles back to how we started our discussion today, that then allows you to be better for other people. And if not for yourself, why not for others, right?
Exactly.
And then that's that positive spin, that positive cycle that I think lifts everybody up.
I think we're going to get you right on in the counseling office.
Oh, well.
You're motivating.
Oh, very nice. I love this. This is great. We thank you so much for your time today and for all the insight. We look forward to having your team circle back again and bring us more valuable information. This has been a pleasure, and the Counselor Connection series has been one that I think has also showcased for our community outside of the college campus listeners that maybe didn't know that we offer these things for our campus, and it's so important. And you know, it's just that whole mindset of positive affirmation, just being good to each other, but being good to yourself first, right? So you can then be better for everybody else.
Exactly. Thank you so much. And just remember, counseling helps people grow.
There it is. Okay. Gwendolyn Pringle joining us today, licensed professional counselor here at Henry Ford College. We have more things on the way. This is the WHFR Journal. Please stay with us.
Here's the deal. We gotta set ourselves up. See, retirement is the long game. We gotta make moves and make them early. Set up goals. Don't worry about a setback. Just save up and stack up to reach them. Let's put ourselves in the right position. Pre-game to greater things.
Start building your retirement plan at thisispretirement.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Susan McGraw here with you, and welcome. We are celebrating all things STEM in this interview. Up next, we're going to hear from a good friend and a great instructor here at Henry Ford College, Charles Irish, and we're talking about STEM Family Day. It takes place Saturday, April 26th. It's a morning till mid-afternoon event, 9:30 to 2, right here on our main campus on the Evergreen location in our science building. That's the J building. So I'm told that Chuck, you are here for all things PR, event publicity. So we got the right guy. Tell us a little bit about what we should expect with STEM Family Day. I remember last year, you know, and they say bigger and better. We'll see.
Yes, I think it is going to be bigger and better. We've got a lot of the things that were hits last year, like the virtual cadaver and the autonomous robots. We've got something new this year. We've got a mathemagician. I don't know exactly what a mathemagician is, but we're pretty excited about it. We're looking forward to that. There's some other big hits like musical physics, and we're going to have a science show after lunch. So we're looking forward to that as well.
Who should be looking into this? Who should participate in STEM Family Day?
I'm going to say that our biggest group of people were third through sixth grade. Roughly. Yeah, we did have some people a little older and some people a little bit younger, but it's really a hands-on kind of activity, not super theoretical. For like, by the time high school, it's probably maybe not as engaging, but definitely hands-on activities. Last year, you know, that age group, they really, really enjoyed them. A little bit younger than that, yeah, they can still enjoy them, but they sometimes don't really understand what's going on there as much. Sometimes some things are a little bit more longer attention span. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to say third through six is sort of the sweet spot for participants. And of course, parents, chaperones, they enjoy it too.
Mathemagician, come on, what's not to enjoy there? I wanted to see what that's all about. The event takes place on a Saturday, so little ones are not in school, thankfully. And again, 9:30 until 2, and I know that there's sort of a whole program of things going on, including a buffet lunch catered by Baba's Grill, who are incredible. And I suspect that you will have just a packed house. So when we're talking to family members, parents, caregivers that want to bring some students in, some children that might be interested in exploring careers in STEM, which, again, if we don't know, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the big ones, the brainiac ones, right? Those yes. are the fields that that will be showcased, and as you've indicated, some hands-on stuff as well. So do we need to call ahead, let you know in advance? Usually when there's food involved, we want to make sure we've got enough.
Yes, definitely. They can reserve a spot in the flyer and the publicity. There is a QR code that they can scan. I'm just going to read off the website. It's tinyurl.com/STEMFamilyDay2025. Mm-hmm. That should get them to the registration page and just a few questions, you know, how many are in your party, that sort of stuff. They'll be scheduled for the event. And again, I do recommend it, not just for reserving a spot for lunch, but it was a real popular event last year. And we want to make sure that people who are reserved, they do have their spot reserved and we have enough for them, activity-wise and food-wise.
I feel like, again, as we continue to look into these fields and make them more exciting and fun and interesting to the younger students, it really is paving a path for them to, you know, get rid of sort of any concerns or break out some of the misnomers or misconceptions about these fields and just, you know, how anyone with an interest and a passion and a desire can participate in this type of a career. So in your experience, Chuck, have you seen any trends, anything changing in the STEM field that maybe we planted some seeds a while ago and now we're starting to see the, you know, see some people coming in that maybe, you know, several years back you wouldn't have expected to be interested in STEM, for example?
You know, as a chemistry teacher, I see a lot of people going into fields that require chemistry, but those students are not necessarily lovers of science. I'll give you a classic example, the nursing students. People go into nursing not necessarily because they love science. They go into nursing because they love people. And chemistry is one of those things they have to master. I mean, I think that's one of the nice things about being a chemistry teacher is you are giving people the skills, the know-how to do something, not necessarily chemistry, but something that they enjoy doing. I used to be an in-home tutor, and I always told people take as much math and science as you can stand, because and then a little bit more, because a lot of people get turned off to those things in high school or middle school or whatever. But the passions that they have, they're going to need those things later. The math, the science. I hope that with Family STEM Day, we can just give them that interest, keep them engaged in those fields. It'll keep doors open for them in the future, I think.
That's a really good way of looking at it. I can't think of many third through sixth graders that necessarily know exactly what they want to do when they grow up. And even if they think they do, often that will change, you know. But like you said, getting that empowerment to plant those seeds so that the doors will be open once they discover the things that they actually have that passion for. So I thank you for that's a good analogy. When we want to register, besides jumping into that tiny URL, I know that we can just go to the HFC website and search for STEM Family Day and it will come up. We trust that all this information will be at your fingertips if you just jump on our website at hfcc.edu. Can't wait. Robots, food chemistry, minerals, that math thing you talked about. Sounds really fun. And again, this is all taking place right here on our main campus in the science building. That's the J building on our Evergreen Road main campus location, STEM Family Day 2025. Chuck, thank you so much for your time. And we looked for a packed house. And thank you again for all the hard work.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you.
And we'll wrap up this edition of the WHFR Journal with a piece that came in about 3 weeks ago. I think it's a good celebration of April being National Volunteer Month. So think about opportunities to give to others in the greater good. This piece from Public Radio Exchange called Turning Surplus Food into Millions of Meals. Enjoy, and thanks for tuning in right here on WHFR Dearborn.
When you look at these displays in grocery stores, these pyramids of perfectly round tomatoes, there's this thought of how does all of that get bought in a day? And the truth is, it doesn't. A whole lot of perfectly edible food end up in the landfill, but also they have to pay money to throw good food away. It's like the world's dumbest problem. In this year alone, we anticipate distributing over 100 million pounds of food. It has been staggering how much excess is out there. Every level that we reach for it, we just see there's more and more.
Welcome to After the Fact. For the Pew Charitable Trusts, I'm Dan LaDuke. The U.S. Department of Agriculture reports that up to 40% of the nation's food supply goes to waste each year. Evan Ehlers had an idea. In his words, rescue that wasted food and get it to hungry people. From that idea sprang his organization, Sharing Excess, which is doing just that in Philadelphia and beyond with amazing success.
At Sharing Excess, we work with food businesses like grocery stores, wholesalers, and farmers to take surplus food that they aren't able to sell. And we redistribute that food out to food banks, shelters, any kind of group you can think of that's feeding people and impacting lives. We will efficiently redistribute that excess food to people that need it. The fact that 40% of the food we produce in the United States goes to waste. It's more than enough food to create over 100 billion meals every year.
That's a lot of food. That's where the excess in sharing excess comes from, right?
Absolutely. That food that we're talking about, I consider that to be the low-hanging fruit.
To use a phrase, pun
very intended here. This is food that is still packaged. It's perfectly edible, and it's able to be easily delivered in a way that it can be redistributed. Not all of the food that goes to waste in America can be repurposed, but there's that section of the food that we consider to be pre-consumer food waste or excess. That's really what we're after. If we just send transportation and we have the right labor and logistics and people involved, we can get that food to organizations quite easily.
It's an ambitious project. You are a young fellow. How did you get started in all of this?
So I'm 28 years old now, but I started the organization officially about 6 years ago while I was a student in college at Drexel University. I had this day that changed my life. I realized that I had over 50 meal swipes left in my dining account that I knew I wouldn't be able to use before I had to go home for winter break. Walking to classes, I would see what poverty and food insecurity looked like in Philadelphia, in the same city, the same community that I was fortunate enough to have these 50 meals that I'm not using. It was kind of this light bulb moment. So I went into the dining hall and I ended up swiping out all 50 of those meals and I put them into the back of my car and I started driving around Center City, Philadelphia and giving the meals away to anyone I could find that needed a meal that day. In 30 minutes, all of the food that I had in my car was gone. And I remember especially there was a mother with her children who was explaining this might be the only meal that they have that day. And they were just so grateful that I spent my time to do this and gave me a hug. Food has this incredible way of breaking down barriers.
Well, it's got to make you feel good. When do you take the next step that says, I could be doing more of this?
After I gave out those initial meal swipes, I just couldn't shake this idea from my mind that there has to be so many other students who also have these leftover meal swipes that they're not using. I started to advocate for a formal meal swipe donation program. When I looked at why all of this food was going to waste, what I really saw was there was a lot of inefficiency with getting this food to organizations that are feeding hundreds or even thousands of people. And if we could just fix that middle mile, then there's a real opportunity to solve a logistical issue here.
And so, Evan found his mission.
47 million people do not have access to at least 3 healthy meals per day. And to me, when I saw the numbers and I really understood the scale of how much food goes to waste in America, it went beyond a personal experience of me with leftover food in my dining account. I saw this as a massive issue that I could probably spend the rest of my life trying to solve.
We'll get back to Evan in a moment, but now we turn to Kristen Romans. She directs the Pew Fund for Health and Human Services, which supports Philadelphia area nonprofits serving people with challenges rooted in poverty.
Food insecurity in Philadelphia is first and foremost the result of the city's high poverty rate. But there are other contributing factors, of course, including, you know, the rising cost of groceries or access to grocery stores. There are ways to alleviate hunger, and I think the city has taken many of those steps. The Philadelphia School District has universal school lunches and breakfasts. But I think, you know, the core to much of this is access to public benefits, right, which are generally funded through federal dollars, some state and some local dollars that give families access to significant economic supports. The Pew Fund supports a number of organizations working on economic mobility, economic advancement issues in the city of Philadelphia. When we think about which organizations to fund, we do want to look at those organizations that are getting to the root cause of economic or financial instability rather than just putting a Band-Aid on the problem. And we know that building assets, getting out of debt, access to jobs, access to public benefits, and having sustaining income are the important building blocks to true economic mobility.
Well, how would you describe economic mobility?
Economic mobility has a few components to it. First is a family's ability to meet its basic needs. Research supports the idea that meeting basic needs is a necessary foundation for families to achieve upward mobility. And then economic mobility includes access to jobs, access to public benefits, and then has an asset component to it as well, right? The opportunity to build assets, to build wealth.
So, of course, one of the things that economic security offers a family is the chance to buy groceries and feed their children. We call it food insecurity. How do we begin to address that?
That's where an organization like Sharing Excess comes into the picture. They've identified this disconnect between food that would go to waste and are finding innovative solutions to connect food with the families who need it. We became interested in sharing excess because it's innovative and adaptable, particularly in its use of technology. One of the things I love is that it has environmental benefits because it diverts food waste that would otherwise end up in landfills. They're unique in activating volunteers to work in and contribute to the community. They are able to connect tangible actions that people can take with their big, ambitious vision.
Evan told us about the impact sharing excess has had on the community, particularly as the organization has grown and they've learned more about how so much food can go to waste. You start with prepared meals that are in a dining hall at a university, but the food, before it ever gets to places like that, they're not sold. For some reason, they don't get to the grocery store from the distribution center.
It was a quick transition from meal swipes to working with grocery stores. Originally, where my friends were cashiers from college, they would convince their managers to let me come and pick up whatever food that they had available that day from their loading dock. And I would go in my grandma's car that she passed to me before she passed on. And I would make this my daily routine in between classes to pick up whatever food that I could. And I'd deliver that food to whatever shelters or food pantries were nearby. They would say, yeah, I'll take the bananas and the peppers and the meat. And then whatever else was left, I'd bring that to the next organization.
So many of us will go to the grocery store, get what we need, and not think about what's still in the bin there at the produce section when we leave.
When you look at these displays in grocery stores, these pyramids of perfectly round tomatoes, there's this thought of, well, how does all of that get bought in a day? And the truth is, it doesn't. It's there for show. And what that ends up with is a whole lot of perfectly edible food in the landfill.
What was the sort of initial reception from grocery stores and elsewhere?
For food businesses, not only do they not want to see this perfectly great product that they work so hard for go into the trash, but also they have to pay money to throw good food away. It's like the world's dumbest problem, especially for a food business that is already operating on thin margins. For us, we have to make our operations as easily accessible for food businesses as possible. We've kind of modeled our approach after a waste management, for example, where they're going to be there every day. They're going to take whatever you have. They'll provide you all of the receipts and all the invoicing, and they make it a smooth process where it can be integrated into a team's daily operations. So that's what we've become over time, kind of like this social waste management process that comes before the food is bad. We're there to take it not only off their hands and off their loading docks, but off their waste bills and get them the tax credits that they can get from a federal or state level because we're a nonprofit 501c3. This was a big win-win for them.
This is like a win all the way around. You're saving them money, not just in their disposal costs, but because they're contributing to society's good. They're getting tax benefits.
Absolutely. It's one of those no-brainer solutions that really is just a matter of us getting to more places and to more businesses. And also, not to mention all of the organizations and food banks and shelters and pantries that are saving money from this process as well, where they're not having to go and purchase that food at prices that stretch their budget so thin that they won't be able to afford the staff or the logistics to run their day-to-day programming.
Sharing excess had barely begun its work when the pandemic hit.
Once we had started creating this kind of localized network throughout the city, there was a huge meteor, essentially, that hit the food system that was COVID. There was a huge increase in food waste because all of these businesses that were prepared to serve months worth of inventory now were mandated to close their operations. And at the same time, more people than ever were either laid off from their jobs or furloughed or were shuttered in their own homes. And the food access points became restricted. We were able to pick up the excess and make the most of it during that time. We grew from our grandma's cars to vans that we were renting to get some funding in the door so we can get a small warehouse in West Philadelphia that used to be a boxing gym, and we repurposed it into this multifaceted distribution center where we could take in truckloads of food and redistribute it out quickly to dozens of organizations in a single day.
We're talking about a much greater amount of food at a given time for you to deal with.
We went from moving hundreds of thousands of pounds of food a year and then tens of millions of pounds of food a year. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around that, but an entire tractor trailer of produce roughly weighs about 35,000 pounds. And so if you were to think about a million pounds of produce, you can get about 30 truckloads of produce in that million pounds of food. That's an enormous amount of impact that we're able to make in communities. It's over $200 million worth of food that we've been able to redistribute.
Tell us the story by the numbers.
We started with 50 meal swipes from my dining account. We anticipate distributing a little over 100 million pounds of food in this year alone. It has been mind-boggling how quickly we've been able to scale, and also equally staggering to think about how much excess is out there, because every level that we reach for it, we just see there's more and more. As we started to build up this larger network, we really started to work with organizations that not only were feeding people, but also were focusing on healthcare or education or protecting people that were in domestic violence situations, senior homes, assisted living facilities. And we have technology that makes this entire process so streamlined and efficient. We're tracking every pound of food that we rescue, so we know where it came from and where it went to. And it creates a picture of progress. We can show not only the food that we're rescuing, but also all of the organizations and individuals that are benefiting from it. And this data is so important when we're trying to influence policy and major decision makers and policymakers around how to improve communities in simple ways that provide a win for everyone involved.
When you're talking about the amount of food, that just sounds daunting to keep track of.
It started from the very beginning for us. I realized quickly, hey, there's no way to really track what I'm doing here. So I started out by buying these package scales. And with every pound of food that I would weigh, I'd put, you know, this was 40 pounds of produce. This is 40 pounds of meat. And I'd add that all up. And over time, that process of working on spreadsheets became an app that can be employed by our entire team to use on a daily basis. You're able to see where the food emanated from and what its end destination was. So this data, we bring it back to the same stakeholders that are supporting us. We can show them down to the pound what the impact was, where it went, and geographically speaking, who we're serving.
Well, it sounds like the work you're doing in Philadelphia can be a model for other places.
We have grown from our humble roots in Philadelphia to redistribute food in over 36 states.
Well, wait a minute. You've told a remarkable story about Philadelphia. I knew you were expanding, but I didn't know it was 36 states.
Now, we're not physically on the ground in 36 states, but we move food in 36 states. We've gotten pretty nimble with our programming here. Where we are boots on the ground is in Philadelphia and New York City, in the two largest terminal produce markets in the United States, where we sort and glean millions of pounds of produce from these markets on an annual basis. But then outside of that, we're working with grocery stores and networks of retail rescue routes in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York City, Northern New Jersey. And outside of that, we're able to pick up full truckloads of surplus produce from manufacturers across the country where maybe they have the same issue that we're seeing in Philadelphia, but all they need is a truck to pick it up. And we can coordinate that truck to pick up the food in Texas, for example, and then deliver that food in Texas to the Texas Food Bank. We're able to take this concept of sharing excess and make it ever scalable, no matter where it is.
But it's a little dumbfounding to me to think that in 5 years, you're in that large an area. That, to me, is a sign of the problem, but also the solution.
When I originally started Sharing Excess, I knew I wanted to be something that goes beyond just food. Now that we're providing over a million meals every week, there's thousands upon thousands of people that are having that same experience I had with the meal swipes, but just multiplied like a ripple effect. I love walking up on one of our pop-ups in Malcolm X Park, for example, every Saturday where we've been there for the last 4 years. And I just see the smiles on people's faces, and our volunteers who've been looking forward to this day in the week for so long. This is something that anyone can do anywhere. We're here to scale human compassion and to grow this basic innate concept that we all have in our hearts. If we share excess, if we make that something that is a part of human nature, the world will be better for it.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about sharing excess and the Pew Fund for Health and Human Services, visit pewtrust.org/afterthefact. For the Pew Charitable Trusts, I'm Dan LaDuke, and this is After the Fact.
From the campus of Henry Ford College, you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.